I am delighted to welcome Joe Finder back to the store. That was the first mystery, is it Finder or Finder? So we've already answered that question.
Anyone know?
We did.
Let me know.
We do have a couple of questions, so I always like to clear it up.
It is Finder. It is. It rhymes with Tinder and Cinder.
Right. John LaSquire is the really tough one. I always pronounce his name for everybody before we start.
You said that Squire? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. A tough name.
Everyone learned how to pronounce Crichton, I think, right?
Yeah,
people Crichton. Learn Crichton, they can learn Finder, Fender.
You have to practice on some of the English with some of their absurd contractions. In any case, I'm really delighted to welcome Joe back. He's on a break from Boston, which is probably a pretty good thing. How was it when you left?
It was around 40. Around 40 degrees.
Awesome.
When I left.
Great.
I was nice just being here.
Yeah. I was just talking to Dana Stavenow. It's 13 below in Homer, so I feel like Boston's getting, I know.
Yeah.
Did you see in Fairbanks tropical. That they've actually been below 30, minus 30 for days and days? There's some kind of cold front.
Where?
Alaska.
In Alaska, Fairbanks?
Which will probably come down and sweep through New England and wipe you off.
Exactly. Somehow.
So yeah. For those of you who signed up for the Writer's Workshop at 4 o'clock, we have a handout, and I will check you in, and then you will get your book, in case any of you are wondering. And if any of you wish to still stay and join, you are welcome to do that. So, Joe, you've taken on, as you often do, a very topical subject in this book.
Opioids, exactly. And this really, you can hear me, right? Okay? Okay. You know, I began to read about the opioid crisis like we all did, and I learned that more people have died from opioid overdoses than died in all the American wars ever, including Iraq and Vietnam, both Iraq wars. And then I started reading about the companies that sell these drugs and the way they sell them. And a number of these companies, Insys is one, Purdue Pharma is another one, they would fly doctors into Caribbean resorts and pay them money for speakers' fees and tell them that the drug was not addictive. And they had studies to prove it. These are doctors.
Right.
And the studies were bogus. And they all knew, all these companies knew how addictive and dangerous the drugs were, and that pissed me off. And when something pisses me off, it's perfect for Nick Heller. And if you don't know who Nick Heller is, that's a whole separate discussion, which I'll be happy to talk to you about. But Nick Heller being my series character. And then I learned about a family that got rich off of, became billionaires because of opioids. And, you know, they were known as great philanthropists. They gave money to universities and museums and stuff like that. And museums and universities began to strip their names off the buildings. And I began to wonder, what must it be like to be in a family that's that wealthy and yet is that hated? And that's when it became interesting to me. Mm. So that was sort of the genesis of House on Fire.
So let me say right offhand, it's not a preachy book about opioids, in case any of you are wondering.
Thanks.
About that. It's not at all. It is the, you know, the engine that drives the story. It poses all kinds of problems, you know, when something like this happens. I was thinking back, we have this craze for naming things now, you know, for philanthropists or corporate sponsors. They've been to San Diego in recent times. I don't know who the guy is, but he, like, bought the city. His name is on the zoo. His name is on, I can't remember how many different institutions in San Diego. I've never heard of him. But, you know, the danger of institutions doing that is becoming clearer when either the family comes into disrepute for some reason or somebody else wants to give even more money.
Right.
There's a hedge fund guy whose name I can't remember who tried to give a huge amount of money or buy his name onto something in one of the universities back east, and the university turned him down. for various reasons I can't recall. This kind of stuff you read about in the Wall Street Journal on a fairly regular basis is where the serious money tends to show up. But I thought that was really interesting. They were anticipating potential blowback, you know, if they accepted his, I think it was actually his wife he wanted to buy this incident, you know, whatever it was, which was a big thing, and do it for. So over the years, we've seen institutions having to grapple with this problem.
Yeah, and you know what really drew me in was the fact that it was a family that we're talking about.
Right, not just an individual.
Not just an individual, not just a corporation. I wouldn't have been interested otherwise. So I came from a family of five kids, and large families have dynamics that are the same across families, I think. I mean, my younger brother, who's only 2 years younger than me, is always going to be my younger brother in all family discussions and meals and that sort of thing. I get the better chair, you know, because I am the older brother. And my youngest brother, who is, by the way, an editor at The New Yorker, my youngest brother was babied by the family. My parents were hard ass on me and my older sister. And when it came to Henry, the youngest, he had an easy ride. So, you know, there are basic similarities, and I figured this might be interesting to sort of dig into what the dynamics are in this wealthy family and have Nick Heller be the lens through which we see the family.
That's so Tolstoy.
Yeah,
exactly. I love that Tolstoy. You know, was it all happy?
All happy families are alike, all...
Unhappy families are unhappy in their own ways, or something approximating that.
Right, I know it's true. But.
Well, you know, that's been, I mean, this is the sort of thing, Rob and I just watched a new version of the ABC Murders by Agatha Christie, which was strangely cast with John Malkovich's Poirot, with one of the worst accents I've ever I could hardly understand him when he was speaking in his faux Belgian accent. But anyway, it came down again, you know, to family, younger brother, money, this whole thing going on with William and Harry, you know, and the heirs and the spare, and also, you know, families that have an enormous amount of money and have succession issues. Are perfect fodder for murder plots, you know.
Have you seen Knives Out, by the way?
Yes,
right?
I did. Yeah.
I mean, I sort of thought of that.
You bet.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's so interesting to me that Agatha Christie is just so hot right now. I mean, they're remaking so many of her books. And actually, I had lost, I won't do a spoiler, I was sure I remembered what the ABC Murders was about, but then in watching it, which was at least one episode too long. They really padded it out to three when they could have done it in two. I thought they'd gone off in a whole new direction, and it was only at the very end when I recognized that they came back to, you know, the whole point of ABC Murders, and maybe it was always like that, and I had just forgotten everything but the final. But Knives Out was like that. I've just finished reading a book set up in the 10,000 Islands on the St. Lawrence, which is almost like a clone of all of that. You know, family with lots of money and, you know, siblings with different positions in the family. And and the family's losing its money, and they hire somebody to come in and try to resurrect the money. So, you know.
The thing I love, though, about Knives Out is that, if you haven't seen it, it's about a very successful mystery writer who's a real asshole, and his kids, who are sort of fighting about his fortune after his death, and finding out how he died and that sort of thing. And I just, you know, a story about a mystery guy who's sort of a difficult character, I should say.
You don't know any of those.
No, I don't know any of those.
We've hardly ever met one of those, no, but it's also Daniel Craig, who's coming back to us with what he claims is his last James Bond movie soon. So it was interesting. Talk about terrible accents, too. Yeah. I thought his Louisiana accent absolutely sucked. Well, we digress. So tell us about Nate Heller, because you're right. He's the guy you send in when you run into this kind of a thing.
Yeah, so Nick Heller began as, well, I've been, I'd heard from readers for years when I was only doing standalones, saying, when are you going to bring back, you know, Adam or Jason or any of my characters? And the thing is about these standalones, I take a character and I turn his or her life upside down.
Yes.
And it would to put them through that in a series of book after book after book would be sadistic.
Well, you were really cruel to the judge, right?
Yeah.
Joe's last book was the last one with the judge, right?
That's right.
The woman, really gutsy woman. And then the one before, I loved the cover. That was the one that had that really fascinating cover with like blocks or something of color on the front. I can't remember. But that too wasn't it a standalone?
What
also?
Was the one before that? Anyone remember? I should know these things, right?
Well, if you don't.
It says it in the book. You're right.
I'll just look it up. Right. Here we go.
It's my 16th book, so you know I lose track.
It was called The Switch.
Ah, The Switch, right.
Right.
Yep.
And before that, so Nick Heller, according to this, has appeared in Vanished, Buried Secrets, and Guilty Minds, and
right.
Now House on Fire.
Right. This is number four, the fourth in the Nick Heller
And then
series.
You have 12 standalones.
Right. That's
so,
right.
But, you know, your point is a good one. A, it would be cruel, but B, also, don't you think that in the standalone, when the story is done, it's done?
Yeah. They're different kind of stories, too.
Right.
And this, when you're basically a series character is an investigator, always, one way or another. I didn't write my standalone characters as investigators. So with Nick Heller, when I got in all these emails, I finally decided to create a character who could basically be in book after book in the long run and have sort of an intriguing backstory that I would bring out in dribs and drabs. But I know all the backstory. I've got a Bible, a Nick Heller Bible I've written. And so I was pretty methodical about the way I thought about Nick Heller. But the main thing about him is, for me, is I love writing, I love being in his head. I love his voice. I love sort of Nick's attitude. He's sort of a contrarian. You know, he thinks something. He doesn't say what he thinks all the time, because what he thinks is you know, sharp. So the Nick Heller character is something that I haven't done book after book. I've been alternating standalones with the series books, and because there's a gap between them, I end up having to reread them each time I start a new book. Even though I've written my little Nick Heller Bible, right. I have to reread, because otherwise I would forget.
Sure.
You know?
Well, that'll get harder when there are more than five of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
if I make a mistake, I will get emails forever.
That's true. You get much more instant feedback. On the other hand, they can also help you if you truly forget something. Several authors have said that, you know, when they are completely at sea about that, they can ask their fans and somebody will always be able to supply the information. So it's kind of useful in that sense.
Next Christmas card,
that's right.
So one of the things I've always loved about Joe's books, they are thrillers, but they're not military thrillers. They're not domestic suspense thrillers. You've always been interested in the corporate world. You've always been interested in business.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that they're not spy stories or, you know, the end of the world unless somebody saves us in Washington or whatever it is. So I've always found your books really relatable, if that's an applicable term.
Yeah, I'm interested in...
Real people.
Yeah, exactly. It's like it's the world that most of us live in, most of us have worked in.
Right.
And that's a good place, I think, to find drama, because, you know, lawyers have been done. There are a lot of lawyer novels. There aren't that many novels that are set somehow in the business world. Now, but I should say, this is not, House on Fire is not set within the corporation. No. It's set within the family.
Right. It's as close to domestic drama as you probably come.
That's probably right, exactly. Yeah. And then I found myself digging into Nick's background more,
right.
His, you know, an old love affair, his experience in Afghanistan when he was almost killed, I sort of brought more of Nick's background into it than I ever had before.
You know, it's a good point. You said he's an investigator, but I think of him to some degree as a fixer, but I'm not entirely sure what I think that term means. But a fixer is a guy that, fixes things, right?
Yeah, so Nick is not just a private eye. I call him a private spy.
Right.
And what I mean is he's not just an investigator like a private eye. He also is an operative.
Right.
He does operations. He'll infiltrate corporations or infiltrate families or whatever it is. He'll infiltrate. And those sort of operations are what make him a spy as well as an investigator.
So in this book, he actually is infiltrating the family.
He basically poses as the boyfriend. I should give you a sense. I mean, I know you're all going to buy the book, so I'm not trying to sell it. But I'll give you a taste anyway. Nick gets a call that one of his best friends, a guy named Sean, who saved his life in Afghanistan, has just died. Sean died of an overdose of opioids. And that already makes Nick angry because he thought the guy had you know, overcome the addiction. And at the funeral, he is approached by a woman who says she is the daughter of the head of one of these opioid companies. In fact, the one that made the drug that Sean overdosed on. And she says she's a daughter of the patriarch of this family. And she wants Nick to dig up a secret that will bring down the company and the family. And she's a rebel. And Nick cannot say yes fast enough.
Right.
So that's sort of, I won't go beyond that, but basically, of course, this being a Joe Fender novel, things don't turn out the way you expect them to turn out, and there are twists and things like that.
Well, I thought it was good that you gave him a personal stake. You know, he wasn't just taking some money or doing something for somebody else. He really felt he owed his dead friend.
Right. He has a personal stake. He's got a couple of personal stakes as the book goes along. He sort of is driven more and more. But it is a pretty straight-ahead adventure story, I think.
Right, so this is one in which what he needs to fix was brought to him. Your standalones, very often the instigating incident, whatever it is just sort of, you know, it is not something that the protagonist does on purpose, but kind of randomly
happens to her.
Right. I mean, now the judge in the last book, just, this isn't a spoiler because it's right at the beginning, you know, didn't have to sleep with a guy in Chicago while she was, you know, on a judicial meeting or something. But that's the sort of thing that lots of people do. It wasn't like she, you know, robbed a bank or carved up a baby or something terrible.
Right.
You know,
right.
She had sex with some guy while she was drunk and out of town. And then goes from there. And I'm trying to remember in The Switch, was that the one with the briefcase?
He sort of, his computer is switched.
Right.
At the airport.
Right, which, again,
it wasn't his fault.
Right. So you like to pitch people, ordinary kind of people, into extraordinary situations, but they didn't do anything extraordinary to get there.
Right. Exactly right.
Which is, I think, really different than a lot of thrillers where you have Reacher, he gets off the bus and he sees, you know, and he leaps in.
Reacher goes looking for trouble.
Right? Yes. Well, we've had quite a lot of discussion about missions, and, you know, characters in long series really need a mission, and they have to have a set of skills in order to do that.
Right.
And increasingly, these are ex-military guys rather than private eyes.
Isn't that interesting? That's true.
It is true. Yeah. I've been thinking about it because I've had a whole series of them here at the store.
Yeah. But. I mean,
that's our discussion every night, right?
Yeah. I mean, Spencer was ex-military.
Yeah.
Was Travis McGee ex-military? Does anyone remember that?
I don't. Well, that's a good question. I don't think so. But Doc Ford, Randy Wayne White's guy, is ex-military.
Yeah.
Reacher's ex-military.
Right.
His brother Andrew, now to be known as Andrew Child. His new guy, Paul McGrath, is ex-military. Nick Petrie is, Peter Ash is ex-military. Chad Dundas, who was here Thursday night with a terrific book, The Blaze, his guy is ex-military, who suffered... he doesn't have PTSD. He has a brain injury, so he has no memories. T. Jefferson Parker, Roland Ford, he's ex-military. You know, it just goes.
Leave it to Barbara.
On.
She knows all this stuff.
Well, it's because they come here and talk to me about it. I'm trying to remember. Is Nate, was Nate Romanowski? Because CJ will be here soon with Nate. Is he ex-military? I'll have to look it up. I mean, he's the sniper par excellence. But I try. Most of these guys who turn out to be snipers or, you know, have these skills, they have learned them somewhere. And since there's not too many boot camp or summer camp for snipers, they usually wind up learning it in the military.
Yeah, it's just much more useful if your character has a set of skills.
Right. So the other one, of course, is the computer geek. You know, the other one is your resident hacker.
Right.
So, you know, that I think creates an interesting.
And Nick is not a computer guy. So he's got a woman named Dorothy who does computer stuff for him. And he'll hire people to do it.
Right.
To sort of dig up information. I find a lot of the computer stuff a little complicated. And I try to make it as simple as possible for the reader and for myself. So I can understand.
Sure. But, you know, Hawk was wonderful, Bubba, and all. But those guys are muscle guys. You know, Joe Pike. They were basically muscle guys. And now that's given way to the computer guy. So, you know, books are reflecting technology and what's going on.
Yeah.
I think in society in all kinds of interesting ways.
And changes, that's right.
They do, right? Yeah. So what's Nick's backstory? Did he serve or how did he become a fixer?
Yeah, so Nick...
the parts you can tell us,
saving
some.
So Nick basically dropped out of college to enlist in the Iraq War and joined Special Forces and was in Iraq and Afghanistan. And in Afghanistan, he is almost killed, and we learn about that in House on Fire. Then he came back to Washington, where he became an intelligence agent, an agent for the DOD, for the Defense Department. After that, Nick went private and moved to Boston and decided to sort of do what he'd been doing for the government on his own for other people. So he's sort of a private spy for hire at this point.
When Joe was here with the last Nick Heller, he sent us a little handbook, or was it Nick's notebook?
Yeah, yes,
that
field
he carries,
journal.
Or his field journal. Thank you. I couldn't think of the name. So some of you may have that if you were here for that book. And so is he a little bit old school still? He actually takes notes in his little notebook?
Or? Yeah. You don't see him. I think he's got an iPhone in this one, though. I did bring him up to the 21st century, but he doesn't do stuff on the computer. That's not for him. He'll take notes on a piece of papers, you know. He's old school.
Which may seem great, right? Well, that's probably all we can really say about House on Fire. I assume you're working on a new book, because you always are.
I always am, yeah. I'm working on a standalone right now.
Oh, okay, so Nick is getting a little rest again.
Little rest, yeah. I've sort of figured out the Nick after this one. So
that's interesting. You're going to go back and forth. Do you find that it brings you more energy? I don't know why this table is rocking like this. It's making me nervous. does it bring more energy to writing the Knicks when you come from a standalone and then vice versa?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's good marketing to do to alternate. I have no idea. But I know that it's good for me as a writer. Mm. It's sort of, it keeps me from getting burned out. You know, I can't blame Lee Child for being burned out after how many 20-some books. You know, it's tough to write a book a year with the same character. And so basically when I come back to the Nick Heller after doing the standalone, it's like going home. It's really kind of a wonderful, relaxed feeling I get being back in Nick's head.
Well, the other thing, or one of the reasons I think it's really good to have authors who do that, is there are stories that just don't fit your series character after you've written them. You've given them so much baggage, so to speak, that there are stories that come along that, A, they can't do because of who they are, or B, it just doesn't fit a series. It's a book where you want to blow up everybody's life and leave it blown up.
Right.
So it does give you a chance to do different kinds of stories. Yeah.
That's right.
Which I think is great. How long have you been writing, Joe?
30 years.
Wow.
Somehow. I have no idea.
And how did you get into this dazzling profession?
You know, I wanted to be a writer when I was a kid, and my parents talked me out of it. They said it's not a way to make a living. And so in college I majored in Russian, and my plan was to sort of work in the intelligence field. And then I was introduced to what that would be like working for CIA. And for a guy like me who was fluent in Russian, that would mean that I'd be translating Soviet economic journals from Russian to English. And I just thought, man, that is not for me, because I
sort of,
no, не очень хорошо. I'd been spoiled by reading Robert Ludlum, and I had this vision of CIA officers as having, you know, Swiss bank accounts and Glocks and fake passports and that sort of thing.
Leaping tall buildings.
Or something fun.
Isn't it interesting that Matt Damon and Daniel Craig are both so short?
Yeah.
Yet they do these amazing things.
And Tom Cruise.
Well, yes, I was glossing over Tom Cruise, right, but very true. I can see that the dream was not going to be the reality.
No, yeah, so I decided it would be more interesting to write. And it really is. Each one of my books, I get to get into something different and explore it, research it. It's writing's a tough gig in a lot of ways, but writing a novel, by the way, is a hell of a lot harder than writing a movie. I just want to say that, you know, or writing a TV series, TV show. But it's also pretty exciting.
We had a discussion with a screenwriter the other night, Chris Howdy, whom you've probably run across, mm-hmm. Deep State. That's an ex-military female, which I think was really fascinating. But we were talking about, you know, the fact that in a screenplay is so spare, and really the camera and the actor fill mm-hmm. in a lot of stuff. But if you're writing a novel, you don't have the benefit of the visuals or the interpretations, so you have to supply all that.
Yeah, also, there are things that you can do in a book that you can't do in a movie.
Like what?
There's characterization. You can't get into one person's first-person point of view. You can't get into someone's head.
Wow, do you remember the Chandler? Any of you seen the movie The Lady in the Lake that they did make, a Raymond Chandler movie? And it was like eye the camera. The whole thing is you see the entire thing in the head of, what's his name? I'm going blank. Philip Marlowe, right. So it's annoying to watch it as a movie because, you know, the camera basically, it's an entire first-person movie.
Yeah.
And as I think as a movie, it's an exhausting technique. I haven't seen it for years.
It probably doesn't really work. Or they do it more often.
Obviously not, yeah, right. But have any of you ever watched it? Well, I'm sure you can rent it, but it's called The Lady in the Lake. And, you know, if you watch it, you'll see exactly what we're talking about, that you can't really do a movie from inside somebody's head looking out.
Yeah, so and there are things that you can do in a novel that you can't do in a movie, and I sort of feel that we have advantages that in the movie that when you write a movie, you know, you don't even have to worry about costumes. You don't have to worry about the way someone's dressed. Someone's going to take care of that for you, right? You don't have to worry about scenery and that sort of thing.
Or even facial expressions and all, because the actors supply that.
That's right. Yeah, so I think it's a lot easier. And I say this as someone who has written movie scripts and TV scripts as well.
Okay.
That writing a novel, that's the tough game.
Have you written a script for one of your own books?
I haven't. I haven't been asked to do that.
Would you?
I would. I think that producers are afraid to hire the writer. They're afraid that the writer is going to be too attached to his darlings, being characters or plot or something like that. and be unable to sacrifice them? I mean, you know, a movie script is 110, 120 pages, and with a lot of white space, that means you've got to cut out a lot of the book. But I've done that. Well, hold on a second. I did come to think of it. I wrote the adaptation for Killer Instinct, which is in development in Hollywood right now. You see, I forgot about it because it's in development in Hollywood.
For how long?
Right.
Right. Forever.
That's right.
On the other hand,
and I was pretty vicious in what I cut out too. So.
With your own.
With my own stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. It would be hard to kill your darlings.
No.
No.
Not at all.
With the paycheck waving at
it was
you.
Fun, right.
Lord. I can see. For any of you who have trouble envisioning this, if you read Tony Hillerman, for example, which is so much about, you know, landscape and legends and interior thoughts and all, they never went to visual. Well, everything sort of failed. But if you read Elmore Leonard, for example, he had an enormous number of books made into films because they were a huge amount of just dialogue,
right?
Without a lot.
That's right.
And then there's the great Chandler story. I wish I could remember who the writer was, but I think it was for The Big Sleep, now that I think about it. Do you remember who wrote the screenplay for The Big Sleep?
James M. Cain, was it?
Somebody like that. Some really distinguished writer. Anyway, Chandler was not great on plot, so at some point when the movie's being made, the writer, not Chandler, called Chandler, and he said, Ray, he said, you know, why does so-and-so happen at this point in the book? And Chandler said, damned if I know. And, you know, I think it would have been hard for him to have, you know, turned one of his books into a movie because plotting was really not
his forte
at all.
No.
Right. I've always liked that, you know, that whole, The Big Sleep is a classic, right? But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense if you watch it. But if you get the director's cut DVD, you will find out why. I'm sure I've told you all this. How many of you heard me mention that before? No? All right, so it turns out that the reason The Big Sleep in the movie doesn't make a huge amount of sense is that it was Lauren Bacall's big thing, and the powers that be at the studio decided to cut a completely necessary scene in the plot in order to give her more face time and to take away actions by another character and give it to her so she would have more face time. So if you watch the director's cut, the scenes that were cut are in there, and then you can see, it's the whole whole thing in the police department and courtroom and all, where the explication of the plot in the book, such as it is, takes place, and in the movie instead is Lauren Bacall doing something, and all of that is ignored.
Right.
So that's an aspect of Hollywood we don't really think about necessarily, is that in trying to bolster just one actor's career, you can sacrifice a lot of the script.
I remember when they were doing High Crimes for my book, they changed the ending. And I said to the screenwriter, so what was that all about? And they said, fine, you can change it, but why?
Right.
And they said, Ashley Judd said it was too similar to a movie she had done. And Ashley was the star.
Right.
So they had to change the ending. And there are, you know, and there are scenes, love scenes between Jim Caviezel and Ashley Judd in High Crimes, in which Jim is wearing a T-shirt, and his contract said he did not have to take off his clothes.
So
all these extraneous seeming reasons, affect what you see, and you have no idea.
Must be unnerving for the author. Oh, well, Michael.
If the movie's good, and it was in the case of the High Crimes, I'm fine with it.
Well,
I was amused by it.
Sure, some people are lucky. Michael Connelly has really been happy with Bush, but he's taken a huge role in making it work.
Right.
Jim Salas was happy with Drive. And then Sarah Paretsky hated every moment of hers, and Sue Grafton refused to ever sell one of her books to Hollywood. So everybody has different experiences.
Right.
You know, you've been lucky.
I have, yeah. I've had two movies made. And Judgment is in development. Oh, oops. Development.
Oops again, right.
They told me, I just got an email from them saying, exciting news coming.
Whoa.
And I'll believe it when I see it.
Well, this is the golden age for taking books and turning them into video.
That's right.
So, I mean, especially as a writer, TV it has series. To be a really wonderful time.
Yeah.
In that sense. You know, you have a much better shot at getting a TV series than you ever, you know, you've had movies. But
there are a lot more TV shows on.
Yes.
Hundreds and hundreds.
And they don't appear to be as desperate, or not desperate, they don't seem to require the star power. You know, you saw Knives Out, for example, and when I read about it, it turns out that once they signed Daniel Craig on, they got the entire cast in something like under 6 weeks because everybody wanted to work with Daniel Craig.
Yep.
You know, whereas if it hadn't been him, they might never have made it, or they might have taken, you know, forever.
Right.
You know, Doug Preston sold his book about the Florence.
The Monster of Florence.
Yeah, the Monster of Florence to George Clooney. But then George Clooney got distracted with everything, and it never got made. So that's the downside of having to have a star power.
Right.
You know, is that if the star decides to go in 14 other directions, or even one, you're screwed.
That's right, yeah. And it happens with movie stars in particular.
As opposed to
being connected to a producer, for example.
I'm going to sign off. This is for a podcast. I'm trying this as an experiment because not everybody wants to watch videos. So I'm going to say thank you, Joe, very much for talking to me.